The USCGC, the United States Coast Guard cutter, Yamacraw. It was named after a tribe of Florida Indians that were dominated by women. The United States Coast Guard cutter Yamacraw was a former World War II mine layer. That's what they are. Them dingbat mine layers I can't put up with. If I were a sensible woman, I'd join Scott's church to prove I wasn't one of them dingbat mine layers. Yamacraw. Former World War II mine layer converted by the Coast Guard to a combination cable laying and research ship. She had a white superstructure and a black hull. That's what they are. Never seen no one of them. It's the black hull you got to watch out for. They stay around long enough, they reveal their true colors. She had a white superstructure and a black hull. Been running from them black hulls for years. The large letters on her hull disclosed her designation. WARC. WARC. That's it. WARC. WARC. 333. The name Yamacraw was derived from a tribe of Florida Indians, and I told you the true matriarchal heritage. Captain of the 189-foot ship with the white superstructure and the black hull, the big letters WARC on it, named Yamacraw. Mine layer was Commander William D. Strouch. What else could he be but Strouched? It'll Strouch anybody to command white superstructure, black pall lettered WARC mine laying Yamacraw. Am I boring you? Her normal complement was 51. The reason you can't get by with some of them mine-laying Yamacraws, you're giving them too few compliments. 51 is the normal. You want to get anywhere with a black hull. On August 8, 1956, the Yamacraw was on a heading at a 165 degrees. Her position was what I said. White superstructure, black hull. Her position was 30 degrees, .65. Am I boring you? North. And 73.80 west. Which placed her in what is sometimes referred to as the Seaweed Sea. Had her black hull in the grass, an area north and east of the Bahamas. And approximately 500 miles east of Jacksonville. Jacksonville didn't know how well off they were. It was 0130 hours when the radar operator called out, "Large landmass dead ahead." Range, 28 miles. Well, that's nothing for this white superstructure, black hole mine layer in Yamacraw. The radar operator adjusted and readjusted his equipment. Am I boring you? I have known Dr. Red Mansion Valentine. He's the one that swam down and got the crystal out of the hands and that pyramid underwater in the Bermuda Triangle. I've known Dr. Red Mansion Valentine since around 1968. I don't know whether he's still alive or not. The last time I saw him, he was ill. This is from Miami, one of our King's Dishes and King's Houses. Send another 200 before the end of the month. I love for you to find out the depths of quality and penetration into all levels of intelligent people that the King's Dish and King's House family reaches. There are people of real quality, and as I said the other night, there's hardly anything we can ever get on that we don't have an expert in the house. The gentleman who dove in the Bahamas into the pyramid and retrieved the crystal ball, that's Dr. Valentine. No, not Dr. Valentine. Was it Brown or Powers? Let's check his name so I'll get it right. I was reading so many of these different people, I even left myself dangling. Yeah, Dr. Brown. The gentleman who dove into the Bahamas, into the pyramid, and retrieved the crystal ball. The ball is very unusual. It repels all metal objects that are held over it. There's TV footage on that. I think his name is Dr. Ray Brown, and I think he still has the crystal ball. There have been some more disappearances in the last few years, about a week before Christmas, 1978 or 79. They were tied up to a channel marker on an in-water way called Government Cut. They radioed for help, then the radio went blank. They disappeared, but the boat was still there. They don't know whether to connect this to the Bermuda Triangle or not, but it has all the earmarks. This person says, in my opinion, I believe that this whole area has something to do with a power plant in Atlantis that's still active. Well, there's something active. And he thinks their energy source was pure crystal. If we have demons in the hole, they may be able to use interesting stuff out there. Let's read about it some more. Let's get back to old Yamacraw. Sister Yamacraw. Her first name was Sal. Large landmass dead ahead. Range, 28 miles. Impossible, responded Ensign Francis J. Flynn. I'd call myself Frank. Impossible, responded Ensign Francis J. Flynn. There's only one landmass on our heading, and that's the Dominican Republic, over 800 miles away. The radar operator adjusted and readjusted his equipment. Again, he called the officer of the watch. Ensign Flynn! Francis! The radar is showing a landmass directly ahead on our course. Take a look for yourself. Flynn studied the radar screen. You're right. It's got to be a landmass. Look how straight it is, almost as if it were drawn by a pencil. Wake up the skipper. I'm going to check the compasses and take another position fix. The sea was flat, smooth. The sky was clear. Every star and constellation that should have been visible in that area was in view. I'm reading from The Devil's Triangle 2 by Richard Weiner. The compasses were correct, and the ensign's sightings tallied with his previous fix. Still, the radar screen showed a huge landmass directly ahead on the Yamacraw's course. Steaming at 12.5 knots, the ship had reduced the distance to 24 miles. Maintain 165 degrees, ordered the captain. Less than 2 hours later, those on the bridge were gazing ahead in awe. No more than a mile ahead, looming up out of the sea, was a large, dark mass that seemed to stretch from horizon to horizon and reach skyward as high as the men could see. The radar, which was capable of penetrating fog, showed this to be a solid mass. Minutes later, the Yamacraw was alongside the huge mass. Commander Strouch ordered his men to rig the 36-inch diameter carbon arc searchlight. As the ship moved slowly along, parallel to the mass, the men noticed that it did not come up out of the water, but rather started about 1.5 to 2 feet above the sea's surface. Shall I read that again? You thought sure I was going to quit, so you weren't listening. Minutes later, the Yamacraw was alongside the huge mass. Commander Strouch ordered his men to rig the 36-inch diameter carbon arc searchlight. As the ship moved along parallel to the mass, the men noticed that it did not come up out of the water, but rather started about 1.5 to 2 feet above the sea's surface. I'd get my black hull out of there. The men noticed that it did not come up out of the water, but rather started about 1.5 to 2 feet above the sea's surface. The ship was less than 50 feet away when the big searchlight was turned on. Yet its powerful beam penetrated no more than a few feet into it. This is U.S. Coast Guard, friends. This is not a TV evangelist ship on a miracle voyage. Gaining experiences for their next magazine. The ship was less than 50 feet away when the big searchlight was turned on, yet its powerful beam penetrated no more than a few feet into it. The radar could not penetrate the mass at all. The light disclosed the color as being a brownish gray. For half an hour, the Yamacross steamed slowly along the edge of the mass. From time to time, the captain would order the ship to penetrate the mass for a minute or so at a time. There was no dampness or temperature change, as there would have been in the case of fog. No one was on the starboard side of the Yamacraw as it eased into the mass. Really now? Then the ship pulled several hundred yards away and continued steaming alongside the mass, which formed a straight line running northeast to southwest. Now, in case you haven't been listening, all we're doing is pointing out some strange things happen in and around the Bermuda Triangle. Am I boring you? You don't believe this story. You really don't, some of you. Any of you been sailors? This is not one guy in a rowboat. You don't really, anybody in here been sailors? You don't really think that a Coast Guard ship full of crewmen would not have one guy that would say it never happened? Those independent guys, with such a report being filed, one of them would say they had too much grog. It's just unbelievable. That, I agree. I find this very hard to believe. In fact, if one guy in a rowboat had told me the story, I'd say he was out in the sun too long. This is U.S. Coast Guard. This is searchlight. Come on now. Searchlight, radar, combined crew. That has to be the biggest and strangest UFO ever reported. Because it was a foot and a half to 2 feet above the sea surface. Now remember that other pilot? What he saw, just the top was parting the surface. Remember Dr. Brown? He was under the surface. Now this could be penetrated, the other thing had openings. Hark back to your physics studies, folks. You have been able to mentally adjust to the fact that in spite of your pretty face and marvelous form, you are mainly hot air. Space warmed by friction of constant moving objects. That if you could gain the perspective, I'm going to make up a word, of a proper atomic particle telescope, to where you could see from the standpoint that atoms and their constituents could be isolated and your relative perspective was such that an atom looked as big to you as an elephant looks to us. You have adjusted your mind. You see, you can see abstractly that we're more space than solid matter, and capable of being penetrated. You have abstractly adjusted your mind that you can't really tell where you begin and where you end. Can anybody tell you exactly where your atoms quit revolving and somebody else's or something else starts? It's relative. That's what makes the philosophers go into their mental seances and argue. And I told you this before, the whole world is divided into two philosophic camps based upon their epistemological viewpoint. Epistemology is theory of knowledge, what can be known and what's knowable. There are only two alternates, and everything else is a part of one or the other. You will either be an idealist in epistemology, and that has nothing to do with the emotional meaning of an idealist. I'm using it strictly in the realm of philosophy, theory of knowledge, epistemology. An idealist believes that things consist in and of relationships, and all that is are relationships. A realist believes that there are entities that exist and they have relationships between one another and are essentially unchanged thereby. And anybody in the right mind knows the realist view is the accurate one. Because from your earliest youth, you were captured. I've covered this before. Maybe I throw it in here. From your earliest youth, our thought patterns were formed by the language frame we were born in. The English language is essentially predetermined to the realist perceptual set. Our verbs change and our nouns do not. I ran home, I will run home, I am running home, I have run home. The verb form changes. But I and home remain unchanged. That's the way our thought structure developed. That's why it's so ludicrous to talk about not having faith. You can't exist without faith. The issue is whether your faith target is a solid ground or false. God dignifies faith. And only will call it faith if you hang your action on His permanence. Anything else is called disfaith. So all of life is faith. The way you view life, you didn't think it through. Frame of reference is what you take for granted as being true without proving it. The difference between an ignorant man and a learned man is he's dominated by a frame of reference, but he knows what it is. Most people are controlled with their frame of reference and don't know it. We view reality a certain way. It doesn't make it right. Our language coerced our thought patterns. And we view reality as having fixed entities connected by relationships. And it's next to impossible to make a Western brain think otherwise. That's why they take Eastern religious thought and graft it onto the Western brain and abort it. Idealists, of which far more of the world's population are gripped in a language frame differently, say nothing exists but relationships. And the philosophers ask stupid questions like, can a noise be heard in the woods when there's nobody there to hear it? Stupid. Anybody knows. Sure, the noise is there. Now, I've done this before. Describe that camera to me. Anybody want to describe that camera to me? You can talk now. What is that camera? It's gray. Well, what's gray? Gray is a relationship. It's a relationship. Color is a relationship. There's no such thing as gray floating around in the space and time. Gray is a relationship. It's the way you view it. What else? Tell me more about the camera. Huh? Metal. That's an abstract description for a mineral combination alloy that has certain traits. You're telling me a relationship that we have reduced down to an abstract summary word. What's metal? I mean, when you just added a synonym, You've got to describe what metal is. What's metal? Tell me, what is that that Peter's standing alongside? We call a camera that's been reduced down in one of its attributes called metal. Well, now, you say it's a construct of... Constructs, that's the word you use? It's a construct of molecules. What's a molecule? Molecule is but a way of describing something that we have identified by extending our relationships through scientific instruments. We get down to what's a molecule. Huh? Still in here. Charged particles. You've used two words. Particles, which describes a space limitation, which is a relationship, and charged, which describes another kind of relationship we have. You haven't told me anything that isn't a relationship. Well, it's square and round. That's a relationship. Well, it's heavy. Weighs so much. That's a relationship. You cannot. I'm telling you, it's rhetorical. That's why I don't have any trouble asking this question. There's nothing you can tell me about that that is not a description or an abstract identifying of a relationship. You haven't found anything other than relationships I'm having with that. What's that? You take as one answer, you break it down into smaller particles by extending our sensory apparatus through scientific instruments. You just have extended the field of relationships. You're still chasing something elusive that can only be described in terms of a relationship we have with it. Now, I'm telling you, going out the gate, there is no way you can find or say anything about whatever that is not a relationship you're having with it. You say it's small, well, small to you. It's not very small, that camera, to the smallest particle therein. Pretty big, in fact. I mean, to the smallest particle therein, that camera looks like the Milky Way looks to those of us on Earth. It's a relationship you have with it. Now, I don't expect this to produce any emotive feel, because we simply do not have the language frame to enable us to conceptualize it, to gestalt it, without coming at it again and again. I'm not sure I can do it or spend my whole life at it. A variety of things, not only the least, but very much a part of your conclusion is the frame you've grown up in. Our language frame conditions the way we look at reality. And any person brought up in the English language knows, I don't care, you can use that rhetoric with me all you want. There's something there and I'm here and we're having relationships and I can't fuck with it. It's there. Any dumb jackass knows it's there. You don't have relationships with relationships. Oh, yes, you do. My professor, who happened to be an idealist, used to say to me, fly over the ocean and tell me where one wave ends and the other one begins. Well, you can't really say where one starts and the other begins, but you can get a feel that that wave's not the same as that wave. There are two waves there. Now make it tough. Where does the wave end and the ocean begin? And what you have is a foci of relationships, he says. And it's easier to distinguish between the foci of relationships than it is the relationship and the reality of the sea. Well, that's philosophers. You know, they're all nuts. Richard Dettering, who was doing his doctorate at Stanford same time I was doing it, and I use this as probably the best illustration, did his doctorate on an Indian tribe that had a language frame. Every time the verb changed, the noun changed. If the verb form changed, the noun changed. They had a fluid language.
And their conception of reality was different. They grew up recognizing in their conceptual frame, you change the relationship, the entity changes. The Mountie in India believes original sin was language, where items begin to be differentiated from one another. And they take a vow of silence, they stare at the sun till they go blind, they go into caves and live in darkness, they stand on their head and look at the horizon in odd directions until they gain an ability to see an undifferentiated mass of color, thereby freeing themselves from the consequence of original sin. I'm not recommending any of this. I'm just saying that if you and I were born in a more fluid language frame, our emotion and temperament would make the idealist view more congenial. Most of the Eastern world views our differentiated reality as appearance and the cause of man's problem and the illusion that keeps him in the wheel of life, and their salvation experience is a trance-like state that delivers you from the ongoing wheel of life. And they won't even define reality. They call it the bat which is behind all that. Undifferentiated nothingness. And the goal of salvation is to escape from any identity with this world and its individuality and its differentiation. Now, the relevance I'll come back to. I'm glad that I find it easy to identify with what God chose as the language frame of revelation. In the fullness of time, God sent His Son. And if I were mentally congenial to the idealist frame, the authority of Christ would move me into the realist frame. But I accept the realist frame not because my language is congenial to it. I'm thankful it is. All the more proof that we are in the domain of the kingdom people, in the election of race. Because God sent His Son and chose to reveal the fullest revelation, where the language frame was the Greek language, which coerces you into the realist view of reality. But the idealist view of reality is all that exists are relationships. You see, you can't prove it either way. It's a faith leap. You simply cannot describe anything in this world other than describing relationships. The idealist says, since I can't find anything but relationships, therefore nothing exists except relationships. And I'm a part of the relationship, and it's a part of me. It leads to pantheism. It makes prayer an inward look. It stops the dialogue. God, instead of being the great other, we're a part of God, He's a part of us. You find God within yourself by losing consciousness. An ultimate reality is to be merged with the stream of ultimate consciousness, which is nothingness. It affects your view of reality. It affects your view of prayer. There is no immortality of the soul. There is no individuality. It lends itself to the communist dialectic, where being part of the force, your immortality is the contribution you make to the ongoing stream. It affects your value judgment. It affects truth. And the average man on the street doesn't know anything about this. But whether he does or doesn't change the reality. That the philosophies of communism, the philosophies of the Eastern religions, all come out of the idealist frame. The realist frame says, I may not be able to locate it. But somewhere, if I could extend my sensory apparatus far enough, or if I had a dimension of seeing, there is something. I can't define it. I can only define relationships I have. But there's something, and I'm someone, and the relationships connect us, but the relationships are separate and distinct from the relator. From that philosophy, you get individual immortality. From that philosophy, you get the dignity of individuality. From that philosophy, you get the reality of freedom's ability to affect his relationships.
From that relationship and that idea of philosophy, you get the concept of prayer in the Christian frame, which is a dialogue with the great other. You get the I-Thou relationship of Martin Buber in the Jewish frame, Reinhold Niebuhr, who picked up on it in the Self and the Dramas of History in the Christian frame. Why am I philosophizing? Why don't we go back to dumping on people for sinning and make God small and pea-brained? I am glad that I'm in a language frame that lends itself to the realist view. I find it easy to view reality from the realist frame, that relationships are had between pre-existing entities. But had I been born in another frame, the authority of God's choice of the Grecian frame and the fullness of time and the situation into which Christ came and the language that God talked to us in the revelatory pattern, which was His choice of timing, would make me a realist. But I have enough philosophy training to respect and see the consequences of the alternative frame and why there's no fixed values, no fixed morality. And what most people do not understand is that John Dewey, who pioneered and fathered progressive education, philosophically called experimentalism, that produced the warped and inadequate value frame of this generation. Progressive education was fathered by John Dewey, and John Dewey was an explicit, fully understanding, and totally committed idealist. His epistemology, from which his philosophy of education flowed, was idealism. And most of the theological concepts taught in most biblical seminaries come out of the German idealism of the 19th century, which is wholly and totally alien. I'm sorry to say, one of my favorite writers, when he got on epistemology, was an idealist, C.S. Lewis. And you will find it when he stretches his philosophic views to the maximum concepts of individuality and eternity. But when he stays on historical subjects, such as the nature of Christ, or when he stays in his gifted realm of writing the parables of the Pilgrim's Regress and other such things, he's without a peer. But he too was in the clutch of the theological mindset. German idealism dominated theology. And it dominates the seminaries today, some of whom think I'm heretical. I went through master's training in college before I ever took a course in philosophies of education. I had to get to Stanford at the doctoral level to find out the philosophic foundations of progressive education. But that comes back to this mass. Even with the philosophic options there and my commitment for biblical reasons to the realist view, so you can all relax. You didn't have to think it through. You're lucky enough to be born in a language frame that makes you a realist without trying. That's the biblical frame, so you're lucky. But even in the realist frame, we don't have the ability yet to understand this molecular arrangement. Now, we don't mind looking at Star Trek and seeing these old boys get on that little old round thing and fuzz away on the ship and unfuzz wherever it was they were headed. We know a little bit about molecular displacement. We become scientific. We can split an atom and get an explosion. We produce so much energy thereby. We mutate reality around it. Literally destroy relationships, create new ones in a harmful, mutative way that could destroy, through the energy produced, mankind and his environment. God, for a long time, has known how to pull it apart and put it together and hold it together and reassemble it. Do you suppose anybody else knows?
the men noticed it did not come up the mast, that is, out of the water, but rather started about a foot and a half to 2 feet above the sea's surface. The ship was less than 50 feet away. Let's get back to Bermuda Triangle. I'm tired of philosophizing. I mean, you know, if I don't stay at least somewhat intelligible to mediocre minds, TV evangelists will not have anything they will know enough to criticize next week. I mean, the last 30 minutes was understood by most of you, but my critics are trying to figure out how they can preach against that. He criticized idealism. I heard it with my own ears. He criticized the blessed faith of the fathers, idealism. Now I've given them their answer. Let's go on. The ship was less than 50 feet away. With the big searchlight turned on, yet its powerful beam penetrated no more than a few feet into it. The radar couldn't penetrate the mass at all. The light disclosed the color as being a brownish gray. For half an hour, the Yamacross steamed slowly along the edge of the mass. From time to time, the captain would order the ship to penetrate it for a minute or so at a time. There was no dampness or temperature change as there would have been in the case of fog. No one was on the starboard side of the Yamacross. It eased into the mass. Then the ship pulled several hundred yards away and continued steaming alongside the mass, which formed a straight line running northeast to southwest. After a few minutes, Commander Strouch ordered the helm eased over to the starboard, and the USCGC Yamacross slowly eased back into the strange brownish gray mass that was impenetrable by either searchlight or radar. The high intensity carbon arc lamp, 3 feet across, that's a big lamp. Ain't no pocket flash. The high intensity carbon arc lamp became only a dull glow.
This is the end of side one.